Our acceptance of Jesus Christ requires that eventually we reckon with the resurrection. There's no way that a person can believe in Jesus Christ without believing in a resurrected Jesus Christ. Someone has said Christianity is, to a greater extent than it is anything else, a religion of resurrection. And also the power or the ultimate dynamic of the Christian religion is not in faith in a God who placed his son on a tree. The ultimate dynamic of the gospel of Jesus Christ is in a God that raised his son from the grave. Now that may seem to be a fairly simple conclusion, and yet I think it's one that needs to be reimbursed and reemphasized as we consider the dynamic of the gospel. In Romans, Paul says that Christ Jesus was designated to be the Son of God in power according to the Spirit of holiness by the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. And Romans, the 4th chapter, simply says that the hurdle which we must cross is in believing that Jesus of Nazareth was raised from the dead by God. Now, tonight I've studied with you at various times about the resurrection. And then all through this week, I've studied off and on about how to go about presenting this subject tonight as we bring the study in the Gospel of John to a close. I wanted us to get to the resurrection before the meeting begins 2 weeks from now. And so I made every effort that I could, that was necessary, in order to get us to study this subject tonight before the students leave for home. And by the time you come back, then our meeting will be in progress. I believe in the resurrection. I believe Jesus of Nazareth was raised from the dead. I find myself pushed into a corner. I find myself sympathizing with his disciples who obviously could not grasp all of the implications of it. I find myself sympathizing with them as they struggled with the reality of it. I find myself trembling with them as he pushed them into a corner and said, "Look, this is it. The jig is up. You're going to believe it. Here I am. You're not going to go away unbelieving." And so I find myself struggling with them in this examination of a very unique incident that took place in history. And so I wanted to study with you tonight for a few moments some of the reasons why I believe in the resurrection. Part of them are at the heart of the issue. Some of them are perhaps on the perimeter. But all of them, I believe, are relevant to the issue. First of all, I believe in the resurrection because the sources that attest to the resurrection are plausible. They are creditable. They've passed the credibility test. You see, the resurrection of Jesus Christ is the cornerstone of the entire New Testament revelation. If Jesus Christ was raised from the dead, then the entire remainder of the New Testament can be accepted without any problem because of the fact that it is of the nature that it can be tested. And we'll get to that in just a moment. But if the resurrection of Jesus Christ is a falsehood, if it's a forgery or a fraud, if it's a fabrication, then you can't accept any part of the New Testament as being right, and it throws us then into a real dilemma. Now, this is the reason why I say that. The New Testament, you see, records certain known and provable facts that are verified by secular history. Now, that statement may need clarifying a bit. There are some things in the New Testament that cannot be proved. The resurrection is one of them. It has to be accepted by faith. But there are a whole host of things that can be proved. They can be put to the test of historicity. They can be put to the test somewhat of scientific examination, though there's not all that much evidence in the New Testament where it touches the scientific. But it can be put to the test of history, somewhat of science perhaps, though I can't even produce anything right off the at the moment to indicate that. But it can be put to the test of archaeology. It can be put to the test of ethics. And when you put the New Testament to the test of all of these various areas of knowledge, let's just limit them to archaeology, history, ethics. These are three. And all of these three can be verified. All of them touch secular history at some point. And all of them, you'll have to conclude, wherever the New Testament relates or deals with these issues, it has to be reckoned that the New Testament is accurate, that it is historically accurate, that it is ethically superior, Every facet of the New Testament that can be tested has always come to be recognized as being true. Now, it is this kind of a record that contains the record of the resurrection. And the reason why I mention it is because we're not dealing with a record that cannot be verified. We're not dealing with a record that can't be substantiated by history. We're dealing with something that wherever it touches known history, the facts that are contained in the New Testament are always shown to be true in every instance. There's never been a historical reference proved to be untrue in the New Testament. There's never been an ethical standard that was ever proved to be anything but the very utmost in the very best way. There's never been any kind of evidence that is contained in the New Testament that touches any part of science or history or archaeology that is not proved to be true. Now, in view of that, when you consider the fact that it is that kind of a record that contains the record of the resurrection, then we're forced into a dilemma. We either have to accept the entire New Testament record, the resurrection included, or else we're forced then to negate or deny the entire New Testament record. But you can't do that, because all of the rest of it is true, and it can be proved to be true. A significant part of it, a portion of it that absolutely has to be reckoned with, you can prove it to be true. That which you cannot prove to be true, like the resurrection, you have to accept it as part of that record. It is so inextricably wrapped up and interwoven into the whole message that if you try to extricate the resurrection record from the rest of the record, you destroy the entire record. Now, some of the other things that can be documented in history, the life of Jesus, it's found in this book. His death under Pilate, all of these, you see, are historical things that can be verified in history. His burial, the discouragement of the disciples, the empty tomb, the sudden transformation of the disciples from a group of people who were totally dismayed and disillusioned and discouraged to a people who were overjoyed and were exuberant. That is documented in the New Testament writings. The phenomenal rise of Christianity, which history records, and which one man makes this observation about. He says that the conquering of Christianity over heathenism was the greatest social upheaval in the history of the human race. So you find that there are many things, and you add to that the conversion of the Apostle Paul. He has 14 writings that are left behind, 13, perhaps 14, that document his conversion to Jesus Christ. Now, I say all of that, and let me just simplify it. I'm working through some of these things, too, and I may not be able to get them across to you at the first, so I'm going to chase them back by for you and me. There's a block of evidence in the New Testament that can be verified. Wherever it touches the secular histories, wherever it touches science, wherever it touches archaeology, wherever it touches ethics, wherever it touches any phase of man's learning, the New Testament is always proved to be right. Then it has that block of evidence that cannot perhaps be proved with that kind of testing. Among those things is the resurrection. But that block of evidence is so inextricably wound in and bound to the other part that can be proved that you can't separate the two. If you separate the one from the other, it destroys the other. So we're forced then to this conclusion. You either take it all or you don't take any of it. That which can be proved will have to be accepted just like that which, or that which cannot be proved will have to be accepted just like that which can be proved. So we're forced to this dilemma. We're pushed into a corner that the evidence that we have about the resurrection of Jesus, as it is wrapped up in the entire record of the New Testament, will have to be accepted as a whole. It cannot be accepted just one part, whichever part you would prefer to accept. And usually, of course, people would prefer to eliminate the resurrection and all the implications of it. Now, the scientific method would require that we accept as a working hypothesis that which is the simplest explanation for the known facts. Now, science says that we take that which is the best and simplest explanation of the known facts as the working hypothesis that we accept in reference to this data. Well, what is the simplest and most obvious explanation of the known facts? What is the explanation about the empty tomb? What is the explanation about the conversion of Saul? What's the explanation about the recovery of the apostles and this coming from utter dejection into real joy? What is the explanation for that? What is the explanation for the phenomenal rise of the church? What is the explanation for all of these, you see, all of these things that can be documented? You can see them in history. What's the explanation for them? Well, the only plausible explanation that I can come up with, the only adequate explanation that can account for these known facts, is that claim to which all of these facts allude, and that is the resurrection. You see, the empty tomb points to the resurrection, and the people identified the cause of the resurrection as being, or the cause of the empty tomb being the resurrection. The Apostle Paul spent his 13 or maybe 14 letters talking about the cause of his conversion was the resurrection. The beginning of the church and the phenomenal rise of it was laid at the door of the resurrection. Everything that we can find that can be attested to as being authentic, everything that we can lay our hands on as being a fact, every one of these things in the record itself points to the resurrection as being the cause of its existence. Consequently, the only logical thing to do, if you admit the historicity of Paul's conversion, the historicity of the empty tomb, the historicity of the depression of the disciples as it turned into joy, the historicity of all of these things, if you admit those things, then you're going to have to admit the explanation that the New Testament gives in trying to show what is the cause of these things, and they all point back to the resurrection as being the cause. Now, there's a second thing, though, in this respect. The New Testament records record the life of the man about whom it is claimed that he was raised from the dead. Now, throughout that record, the man himself pointedly says that he was going to be raised from the dead. Now, I don't know whether you see the implications of it or not, and let me chase it by you again. The New Testament record in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John records the life of that man whom these other men in the rest of the New Testament claim was raised from the dead. All right, well, so what? Just this. In every part of that man's life, he makes specific and pointed reference to the fact that he was going to be raised from the dead. Now, I'm not going to take the time tonight to go through all those references. You're familiar with them, where he told his disciples that he was going to have to be killed, buried, and raised again on the third day. The Synoptic Gospels mention it, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. John's Gospel refers to it in allusions. John's Gospel records in John 2 the conversation in the temple where Jesus told the Jews, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." John says he was talking about his body, the temple of his body. And then in John 10, Jesus, talking about himself as the good shepherd, says, "I have the power to lay down my life. I also have the power to take it up." Now, what I'm saying that, the reason why I say it is this. These references to the resurrection, just like the references to the resurrection in the rest of the New Testament, the references to the resurrection in the life of Jesus are so inextricably wound in and bound to the entire life of Jesus that you can't take those things out of his life. They're in there. They're a part of the narrative. They're a part of his life. And if you try to extricate the references to the resurrection, you just simply destroy the whole record. You can't take them apart. So here again, we're forced to either take the entire record or leave it all alone. We're forced to say it's all true or else none of it's true. And yet, we can't do that really, can we? We can't bring ourselves to say, "No, I just feel like it's all a fabrication." We know that isn't true. And yet, if you're going to accept any part of it, you must accept it all. So Jesus Christ puts his stamp of approval. Jesus Christ goes on record. And here we're drawn then to the same conclusion. The only adequate explanation is the claim to which all the facts and Jesus himself point to as the cause, and that is the resurrection. Now, you may say, "Well, now all of that's still skirting the issue. Let's come and see what the record itself says about the event itself." Well, the record, when you get down to the record of the event, you're shocked to find out that there isn't any record of the event. There's no record of the event of the resurrection. No one was there to see it, and no one records what happened. The only thing that we have is an account of some things that happened in the wake of the resurrection, and that's all we've got. There was no one there as an eyewitness telling what happened. There was no one even who, by the revelation of God, told what happened in the moment of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. But we do have certain things that happened and are recorded as taking place in the wake of the resurrection of Jesus. And I want you to notice a few of those tonight. Reports began to come in. Some of them were true, some of them were false. Some of them were out of fright and were exaggerated. Others were just out of doubt and were twisted.
Let's notice a few of them, if you will. Let's go to the evening of that first day, the first day of the week, after he was resurrected in the morning. Then that evening, the 10 apostles were in an upper room in Jerusalem. Thomas was not with them. Judas had hung himself and was dead. But the other 10 disciples were in the upper room. They were behind closed doors, and it implies that they were locked because of fear of the Jews. And on that occasion, the 10 disciples, it is recorded, they saw Jesus. He just materialized in their midst. It must have scared them. It must have terrified them. In fact, it says they were just terrified. And on two occasions in the same incident, he says, don't be afraid. Be calm. It's all right. It's I. And he approaches it as though it was such a traumatic experience for the people. Well, you see, he had been seen. They knew he was dead. There's no doubt about it. They stood there and watched him at the cross. They knew he was dead. What would you do had someone that you knew was dead and you had seen him buried on Friday and here on Sunday night you see him standing there in your midst? What would have been your reaction? The same as theirs. It wouldn't have surprised me if they had all fainted or had died of a heart attack. It wouldn't have surprised me, because that's what would have happened to you and me had we seen a friend of ours whom we knew to be dead and now 3 days later was standing there in our presence. But that's what happened on that occasion. John records it in John 20. Luke records it in Luke 24. And those are the two major ones that we'll refer to tonight, though we'll refer also to Matthew. But then let's back up a few hours from the upper room experience and the appearance of Jesus to those men. Let's back up this way a bit. And we come to two men, one of whose name was Cleopas. The name of the other man we do not know. But they were on their way home to Emmaus from Jerusalem. Emmaus was about 12 miles or so north of Jerusalem. And toward the close of the day, these men began to make their way on back home. And they were very dejected. And a stranger meets them and says, "What are you men talking about?" And they said, "Are you the only stranger in Jerusalem that is here that doesn't know what's happened in these few days?" And he said, "What things?" And they said, "About Jesus of Nazareth, a man that was mighty in deed and in word." And they began to tell him, and they says they stood still and looked sad. They said, "We had hoped that this man would be the one that would redeem Israel." But now it's been 3 days, and they go on and tell them the details of the things that had happened and the sketchy evidence that they had, and how that the women had said that they had seen an empty tomb, but they didn't see the man, the body, and all these things they find themselves explaining to this stranger. And so they went on to the city of Emmaus, or the little town of Emmaus, and it was getting toward dark, maybe just a bit earlier than this here, this hour, and they said to him, "Why don't you stay with us? It's getting dark. You need to come on in and stay with us, have supper with us." And so he said, "All right, I will." So he went in and stayed with them. And they put on the table the supper they were going to eat. And he took the bread and broke it, and they recognized him. It says their eyes were opened, and they recognized him. And then he just vanished out of their sight, just absolutely became invisible. They turned to one another and said, "Didn't our hearts burn within us as we were walking on the way, as he explained to us the scriptures?" And it says they got up that same hour, went back into the city of Jerusalem, went up into the upper room, burst into that room ready to tell what had happened. But the men that were there interrupted them and said, "Well, the Lord has indeed risen, and he's appeared to Peter." And then they told them what had happened on the road to Emmaus and how that he had been made known to them in the breaking of the bread. That's another event, you see, that happened in the wake of the resurrection. The event there in the upper room, then the event back up this way toward the event itself, the event on the way to Emmaus. And then there's another one, and that was an appearance to Simon Peter, which none of the Gospels records, and yet Luke records them telling these men from Emmaus that he has appeared to Peter. Now, the Apostle Paul, in the 15th chapter of 1 Corinthians, as he lists the appearances, it just simply says he appeared to Cephas, then to the 12. So we know that he appeared to Cephas prior to his appearance in the upper room to the 12, and he calls them the 12. Really, they were just the 10 there, but it was the body of the 12 with two of them missing. But he appeared to Cephas during that afternoon sometime, and it was probably before that appearance to the men from Emmaus. So you've got the event in the upper room and coming on back toward the empty tomb. You've got the event on the road to Emmaus. Coming on back a bit, you've got the event of the appearance of Jesus to Simon Peter. And then perhaps you have the appearance to James, to John, his brothers, to the 500. We don't know when these appearances took place, but Paul mentions them. And They are historically recorded, but we don't have any record or any details about them. But all of these things are pushing us on back toward the event itself. And then you come on back to the morning that it happened, and you have the event of Jesus appearing to the women, Mary and these other women who were with her. There were some other women there with Mary, and Jesus appeared to all of these women. Matthew records this. In the 28th chapter of Matthew, he records that Jesus appeared to these other women. He met them as they were going somewhere. It doesn't say what time or where, but nevertheless, he appeared to them, and they went and told it to the disciples. And then you come on back a bit more, and you come to an event where Jesus appeared to Mary. And then you come on back a bit further, and you find the event of the open tomb and the empty tomb. And that's a very interesting event, and that's what's found in John the 20th chapter. Mary misread it. Mary came to the tomb. In fact, John doesn't even say that she went in and saw that the tomb was empty. It just says that when she saw that the stone had been rolled away, she ran back and told Peter and the other disciple whom Jesus loved. She went back and told them, "They've taken the Lord's body away, and I don't know where they've laid him." Well, Peter and John, hearing that, ran to the tomb. John outran Peter, but he waited, as hesitant as he was probably, not as blustery and as Peter was. Here came Peter down the road, and just like Simon Peter, he burst right into the room, you know, right into the tomb, and looked around, and it says that both of them saw something that startled them, and it mystified them. I want you to notice this, that the empty tomb in and of itself did not bring them to faith. The empty tomb in and of itself caused these people to think that somebody had stolen the body away. That's all we can conclude. Mary thought it. These other disciples, when they came in, they were confused also. But John records that both John and Peter saw something that caused them to be mystified. Peter went on home. One reference in Luke says, and it doesn't appear in the later manuscripts or in the earlier manuscripts, and it's left out of some of the later translations, but it says that Peter went home and doesn't say he was confused. Well, anyway, I can't think of what it was now. He says the word that he uses there to describe it, that Peter went to his home, and the word is similar to the word mystified. He was mystified about it. He didn't know what to think. But John's gospel records that both he and Peter saw these things, and watch what it was that he saw. They saw the wrappings that were around the body. They saw these cloths lying. Listen, if you will. They both ran, but the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. And stooping to look in, he saw the linen cloths lying there, but he didn't go in. Then Simon Peter came following him and went into the tomb. He saw the linen cloths lying, and the napkin, which had been on his head, not lying with the linen cloths, but rolled up in a place by itself. Then the other disciple, who reached the tomb first, also went in, and he saw and believed. For as yet they didn't know the scripture that he must rise from the dead. Then the disciples went back to their homes. But you see, there was something about these cloths, at least, that belied the rumor of Mary. You see, Mary said somebody's taken him away. And it may be that all this says was that when they saw that the cloths were lying there, that it made them know that Mary's report was not true. Because had someone stolen the body away, they would not have taken the time to unwrap it and take that naked dead body out of the tomb. That wouldn't have happened. And so when they went in there and saw the tomb empty, but they saw the cloths lying there, it says John believed. Now, I personally believe that they saw the cloths lying as a cocoon. They saw them lying there just as the body had lay there. And the cloths were not unwrapped, but that they were there lying as a cocoon and had the shape of a man's body. The napkin was not with that group of bandages. It was separate. Now, the napkin that he's referring to was a turban-like wrapping of gauze around the man's head and up under his jaw to keep his jaw from sagging. And the corpse then had this bound so that his jaw would stay in place. And it was this that they saw separate from the other wrappings that only, as history says, as the Jewish records record, they only wrapped them up to their armpits, and then the man's arms were crossed over his chest, and then this wrapping around his head to keep his jaw from sagging. Now, if it's true that this is what that they saw, something that they saw caused them to think that Jesus Christ had been raised from the dead. What form the rags were in, I don't know. But I'm beginning to suspect more and more that the form of these wrappings was sufficient to cause them to know that something really unique had happened in history. And John went home believing. Simon Peter went away perhaps confused. But now, in all of this, there's some strange phenomena that must be reckoned with. Some phenomena that's so strange, it must have caused chill bumps to run up their back and the hair to stand up on the back of their neck. Notice, if you will. Jesus came in all of these appearances. We have some things that we can trace. He came in such a body that would materialize just out of clear space. It would just all of a sudden materialize. Now, John 20 says that. So does Luke, the 24th chapter. In that record there, it says that they were standing there, and he just simply appeared in their midst and said, "Peace, be still. Peace. Don't be confused. Don't be afraid. It's I." All right. So he just could materialize out of space, and then he could disappear just as quickly. In Luke, the 24th chapter, when the two men from Emmaus had gotten to their home, Jesus was there with them, and at the breaking of the bread, they recognized who it was, and he just vanished into thin air. He vanished. Something else. This man could be felt and seen. On the night after his resurrection that morning, a week after that, when Thomas was with them, and Thomas had said, "Lord," he said, "I'll not believe unless I can touch my hands into his nail prints and put my hand into his side." Jesus then told him on that second Sunday night, he said, "Thomas, come here and put your finger in my nail prints and put your hand in my side, and don't be unbelieving, you believe." So he had a physical, corporal body, a body that could be seen, a body that could be felt, a body that could be recognized, and yet also a body that could be just disappear. He was a man in a body who could be felt and seen. He could materialize and disappear. Here's something else. We find him in a body that was compatible with, but not dependent upon, physical food. In Luke, the 24th chapter, it says that Jesus, when they were still disbelieving for joy, it says, Jesus looked around and said, "Do you have anything to eat?" And they went and got him a piece of broiled fish and some honeycomb and gave it to him, and he stood there and condescended to consume this physical food, which says simply that his body that he was in was not incompatible with physical food, and yet I doubt that anybody would say that he was dependent upon physical food. Something else. He was also recognizable, yet he was capable of going about incognito. He could either be recognizable or he could be unrecognizable. And this is all through these resurrection appearances. On the Sea of Galilee, John, because of something Jesus said or did, looked over there and said, "That's the Lord." Simon Peter jumped in, swam ashore. They sat down and ate breakfast at Jesus' invitation. And then afterwards it says that no one dared ask him, "Who are you?" Because he said they knew it was the Lord. Well, there was something about his appearance that was, well, it was just wonderful and it was awesome. And I can't explain it. I wasn't there. But what I'm doing is simply gleaning from the Scriptures some things that show us that there was just something about his resurrected body that was absolutely awe-inspiring and probably downright scary. He could be seen, and yet he was invisible at times also. Materialize, he could disappear, he could be felt and seen, he was compatible with but not dependent upon physical food, recognizable but yet capable of being incognito also. So you have all of this that happens. I don't know what happened. Man, I know one thing. We're in touch with something that happened in history that's totally unique. We see Dr. Spock and all that crew materialize, on the Enterprise. And we see them just simply dematerialize. We call it energizing and, I guess, de-energizing, and they appear and disappear. And we've come almost to accept that as a matter of fact. And some scientists are saying that it is technically possible that that actual thing can happen. Whether that's what happened here, I don't know. But I do know that they were confronted by a man who could be visible and invisible, a man who could be recognized and at the same time be unrecognized, a man that just, they didn't have any pigeonhole they could put him in. But all of these are just simply, as I said, these are not the event themselves. They're simply events that took place after the event of the resurrection, in the wake of the resurrection. Now, one question as we close. What would have been seen had someone seen the actual event of the resurrection? Had someone been sitting in the tomb and sat there and early that Sunday morning could have seen what happened, what would they have seen? I am personally convinced, because of Matthew's record of it, that they would not have seen a man sit up bolt right in the tomb there and began unwrapping this binding off of him. I don't think that's what they saw. I don't think that's what they would have seen had they been there. I don't think we would have seen that had we been there. You see, Lazarus had to be unwrapped. Jesus didn't have to be unwrapped. I'm convicted he didn't have to be unwrapped. I believe that he just simply disappeared. I believe that his actual physical body had been so transformed by the power of God that he was carried not back into this life. He wasn't restored to physical life, you see. He was resurrected into a plane of living that is immortal. It was a plane of living with which we're not acquainted yet. We're on our way there. And the Apostle Paul describes it in 1 Corinthians 15 as being different from that body that's planted. He said, "You foolish person." He said, someone's going to ask, "With what kind of a body are the dead going to come forth?" He said, "You foolish one, don't you know that the body that comes forth is not the body that you plant? You plant one body, you get another kind of a body. But it's the same body, but it has gone through this metamorphosis, this transition into a higher plane." That's what Jesus experienced. And had they been sitting there watching what happened, I believe they would have not seen a person like Lazarus was done to. They wouldn't see him sitting there unwrapping himself. They saw him just simply evaporate, to disappear, rather, into another realm. The body just disappeared. He was not restored to this life, but to the life of immortal life or immortality. You know, the stone was rolled away not to let Jesus out. The stone was rolled away to let us in. And Jewel Miller notwithstanding. You know, the picture of the film strips has the soldiers there in this ghastly, you know, it says they trembled like dead men. But it wasn't at the appearance of Jesus they trembled. They trembled when this heavenly messenger came down and rolled that stone away and sat on it. It says they trembled at him, but they didn't see Jesus. Jesus was already gone. And the same kind of body that could come through a closed door in an upper room in Jerusalem, that same kind of a body got out of that tomb without anybody rolling the grave, without anyone rolling the stone away. They rolled the stone away to let you and me see that it was empty. It was already empty. He didn't walk out through the door that they brought him in. Well, so many other things could be said about it. All I'm trying to do is get you to realize that something unique happened, and that you're a part of it. And the same thing that was there true of him is true of us in the prospect. We're going to be like him one day because we're going to see him just like he is. And we're going to be transformed into his glorious body, Paul says. We're not going to be in our earthly body then. We'll be transformed into the very likeness of his glorious body. So we're confronted with this event. The world laughs at it. And yet, if you look real closely, the event of the resurrection is not incompatible with the entire whole human scene of knowledge as we know things. When you plant a seed, it comes up. That's evidence of a change in the body. The seasons, winter coming now into spring, and then you just name it, so many things that show us that really the idea of a resurrection out of the dead is not really incompatible at all with what we know about the earth and with what we know about seeds and what we know about the springtime and all that. It's not incompatible. The degree to which it hits us and affects us, of course, is extreme. But I'm convinced that simply we're confronted with now a phenomena, a very unique phenomena that took place one time in history in the Lord Jesus Christ. It's well documented. It's placed within a record that can be tested and proved. It is so interwoven in this record that you can't extricate it. You can't take it out. You're going to either have to take all of the record or none of the record. You're going to have to take all of Jesus Christ or none of Jesus Christ. And once it's that well attested, I don't see how you can do anything else but accept it. I believe in the resurrected Jesus Christ. And I believe he's going to come one day. We baptized a boy this afternoon. I said, "Do you believe that Jesus is what he claims to be, the Son of the living God?" He said, "Yes, sir, I do." I said, "That's a mighty big pill to swallow, sir." And I said, "And you believe that?" He said, "Yes, sir, I do." And I said to him, "You know, one day we'll know." I said, "We can't prove it right now, but we've got enough evidence that we can base our faith on it with real, genuine assurance. But we don't know it. We believe it with all of our hearts. The evidence is sufficient to produce that kind of faith. But," I said, "one day we're going to know." And I told him, I said, "Sir, the atheist has everything to lose and nothing to gain. The Christian has everything to gain and nothing to lose. Because if in that day, we find out, by the way, the atheist was right, we're not the loser. But if in that day we find out that the atheist was wrong and Jesus Christ was right and he really was raised from the dead, then we've got an inside seat on the 50-yard line right there with the Lord. And we're going to be on our way into eternity. It's just that simple. You say, that's kind of a gamble. Not really. The evidence is so strong that supports it that anybody who will place his confidence in Jesus Christ, he'll not be made to be ashamed. It's that secure. Would you like to be a part of that today? You can be. If your faith in Jesus Christ has already prompted you to come to that point where now you're confronted with the reality of the resurrection, and it's either throw away this magnificent revelation or accept the resurrection. It either means that you throw away all of Jesus Christ or accept him as the resurrected Christ. Won't you take that step tonight, right now, and come forward, confess your faith in him, be immersed in this simple ceremony, be raised to walk a new life just like he was raised, and it's in honor of his resurrection that you're raised. We urge you to do that right now as we sing this song of invitation. Come right now, won't you, while we stand and sing.